Welcome to Secure Talk, a podcast for security news, innovation, and excellence. Secure Talk is hosted by Justin Beals, founder and CEO of StrikeGraph. Justin has a 20-year career in technology, innovation, and startups.
Hi there, everyone, and welcome back to Secure Talk. This is your host, Justin Beals. It's now been about 2 months since I started hosting Secure Talk, and I've had an absolute blast with some wonderful guests, and we have some really exciting episodes coming up on the podcast as well. Continuing our deep discussions about security, its effective implementation, and the innovations that are coming along with it. Today, we're going to do something a little different. We have a bonus episode planned for you. And what we've done is we've gone back through some of our prior episodes where we've reviewed breaches that are going on in the marketplace and organized them into this bonus episode for you. And so today you're going to get a chance to hear about the 23andMe data breach using credential stuffing with Stephen Farrell of Ideagen, government email hacks on Microsoft 365 with Paul Bingham of Western Governors University, the ransomware attack at Whitworth University with Raffaele Mattone of Judy Security, and a takedown, then the resurrection of Lockbit with Alex Cox of LastPass. As always, we love delivering these episodes to you. And if you enjoy listening to them, please subscribe and let us know if there's something you'd like to hear. I hope you enjoyed the show today. Thanks for joining us. We've had a breach in the last 6 months that I find really interesting. I think you might have some perspective on it. And so today we were thinking about talking about the data breach that happened with 23andMe, 23andMe.com. Stores genetic data, DNA data, about consumers. So that's kind of they're an interesting beast, I think, in the life sciences space. I certainly used it a long, long time ago. I was just really interested in ancestry information through DNA and found it really intriguing. So, you know, just to highlight that I'm a user of the system, although I'm not yet aware if I've been affected by the breach itself. I haven't done that research, but I did go and do some research on the breach, and I'd like to provide us a little bit of background on the breach itself. So just looking back, on October 3rd, information came to light that someone was attempting to sell data on 23andMe via the dark web for between $1 and $10 per record. So that was the offer on a dark website to buy this data that had been stolen from 23andMe. The data included the display name of the record, the gender identification of the record, the birth year of the record, details about genetic ancestry results. It would say things like broadly European or broadly Arabian. It also included some more specific geographic ancestry data. The hack was perpetrated by credential stuffing. And my understanding of credential stuffing is this is where one system gets hacked and someone has used the same password or username for a secondary system, and they're able to use those credentials to log into a secondary system because it hasn't been updated and gain access to that data. And it looks like 14,000 user accounts were breached using this technique. It's quite a number. And I think one of the things that's really interesting about 23andMe is that it allowed 6.9 million records to be stolen. So well beyond just the 14,000 user accounts. And I think that's something I want to chat about a little bit. And final thing that is a really interesting twist about this hack is that when the data was first produced, it focused on Azerbaijani Jews. So the data that was made for sale publicly, at least in the initial posts on the dark web, were kind of focusing on a particular genetic segment or ancestry segment of the data, which has just got an interesting political twist to the whole thing. So first, I think, Stephen, let's talk about the risk a little bit. So just because you're collecting consumer DNA data doesn't mean that DNA data isn't a risk in a way, right?
It's one of these things where having sort of a DNA profile in isolation, you know, what can you do with it? But I think if there's enough personally identified information tied to it, then you have an element of knowledge over someone that you wouldn't typically have, right? And like, why does that matter? So, you know, there's different aspects to it. Being able to determine if, you know, based on someone's DNA, if they're predisposed to certain conditions, that might be something that people don't, you know, want to have shared, right? I mean, I think it's a very slippery slope because there's so much that you can glean from that type of thing that can be used in a negative way. It really causes, you know, pause, because I'd like yourself, Justin, I didn't sign up for that service, but I signed up for another one. So there's definitely curiosity to sort of understand our origins, but I think you give up an awful lot of privacy when you do so.
Including all the people you're connected to. You know, we go from 14,000 hacked accounts to 6.9 million records. This is a data shift that is really intriguing.
Well, it is. And the thing about that that is interesting to me, right? So one of the parts of ISO 27001 is that concept of secure development, right?
Mm-hmm.
Secure development practices. And uniformly, when we're sort of helping somebody work through that, I shouldn't say uniformly, not everybody, but a lot of people are like, what does that mean? Right?
Yeah.
But I think this is case in point, right? If you can have 14,000 user IDs and somehow get access to 6.9 million other users, there's obviously something in the structure of that database that hasn't considered that risk, right? And once someone has the keys to your front door, they have access to your whole house, right? So that kind of secure segregation of that data, obviously, we're not speculating, clearly wasn't there, otherwise there wouldn't have been 6.9 million people. But again, it speaks to, you know, the importance of having those certifications and actually living and breathing them.
The other thing I always find intriguing, Stephen, when we deal with life sciences space, especially like the healthcare type of space, is that we have so much opportunity to monetarily prize the breach, right? We know that they were attempting to sell these records between $1 and $10. Even at the median, you know, that's $50 million worth of value on the dark web, like right off the bat. That is a massive amount of money for a hacker. You know, you have to understand the opportunity of crime presented by that particular data, I think, if you're operating an organization like this, right?
Yeah, I mean, data's gold, isn't it? I mean, it really is. Every aspect of our life is impacted by it. I mean, I guarantee whatever you and I have talked about, my personal assistant, whose name I won't mention, will have been listening, and I'll have an advertisement on my phone in about 20 minutes, right? So
right.
Probably for 23andMe, I wouldn't be surprised. But I think that's it. I mean, data is such a huge commodity. And the rise of AI, it's just incredible what we can now do with understanding the demographics of a group of people. It's amazing.
To wrap up a little bit around 23andMe, I'm going to talk about their response. So I did a little research on 23andMe's breach response. It was pretty standard breach response. They reviewed the breach, the data that was offered. They investigated the method of the breach and responded to the breach by forcing a password reset on their users, which of course would hopefully stop the credential stuffing work that had enacted the breach initially. However, I did want to talk about one aspect of this. Now, 23andMe is under litigation for a class action lawsuit now around this particular breach. And of course, this is a legal response, so I want to highlight that. But the legal response stated this: 23andMe believes that unauthorized actors managed to access certain user accounts in instances where users recycled their own login credentials. That is, users used the same usernames and passwords on 23andMe.com as other websites that have been subject to prior security breaches. The lawyers then state, and users negligently recycled and failed to update their passwords following these past security incidences. The legal document then says, therefore, the incident was not a result of 23andMe's alleged failure to obtain reasonable security measures under the California Privacy Rights Act. I have to say, this is a struggle for me, right? Because I can think of a million ways in software we can ask people to update their password. And I realize they're fighting a lawsuit here, but it just seems to me there were some security controls that could have been put in place here.
Yeah, to your point, right? Just sending out an email every 90 days saying, hey, update your credentials, or even having a timer so when you go and try and log back in, it says time to update your password. I mean, even that's basic, right?
Yeah.
And then as I said earlier too, the concept of secure development practices, like how, you know, conceiving if somebody was compromised, what could a hacker get from that experience? So, oh yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, to your point, it's a legal response, but it'll be a tough one to argue, I suspect.
Today, we're going to be talking about a Microsoft breach. So beginning in May 15th of 2023, a China-based threat actor named Storm0558 used forged authentication tokens to access user email for approximately 25 organizations, including government agencies and related consumer accounts to the government agencies in their Azure public cloud system. Now, it seems in the breach that Storm0558 had primarily targeted U.S. and European diplomatic, economic, and legislative governing bodies and individuals that were connected to Taiwan and Uyghur geopolitical interests. Microsoft said that the hackers acquired one of its consumer signing keys, or an MSA key, which the company used to secure consumer and email accounts. Originally, Microsoft thought that the hackers were forging authentication tokens using an acquired enterprise signing key, which are used to secure corporate and enterprise email accounts. But what Microsoft found out was that the hackers used a consumer-grade key to forge these tokens, which then allowed them to break into enterprise inboxes. And Microsoft said that there was a validation error in Microsoft code around key authentication. And the data that was breached were email communications for these government and organizational workers. So that's a little bit about the breach that Microsoft suffered. This happened between May, and now we'll talk about the response really quickly. Identification of the campaign happened on June 16th of 2023. The investigation identified the inactive MSA consumer signing key that was used to forge the tokens, and Microsoft quickly eliminated that key as being a valid key. Now, the hackers did make a mistake by using the same key to raid several inboxes. Microsoft was allowed to see all the access requests that had followed the pattern. So they were able to know exactly what data was compromised and notify those who were affected. And of course, Microsoft identified the root cause, established a durable tracking of the hack, and disrupted malicious activities. They've since hardened their environment, notified impacted customers, and coordinated with multiple entities. So this definitely lines up with that third-party actor. We have a critical private enterprise that's storing information for government entities. It really hybridizes, I think, a lot of your experience. And the first thing that popped into my mind was key hijacking can be such a serious data breach. And I was really kind of surprised that we weren't testing consumer-grade keys versus enterprise keys, or that keys were invalidated appropriately.
Yeah, I in addition to the technique, it's a level of sophistication, too, that we don't see in a lot of network attacks that smacks of, I mean, this one references this Chinese-based group, Storm0558, and it reminds me of, which I was frankly disappointed that it doesn't have a panda name associated with it, because most of the APTs out of China have something with panda, like the Russian groups that are something with bear in the name. But it definitely reminds me of the sophistication. I would say, if I segue for a second, that I used to sort of say that, you know, most of your typical network intrusions or attacks, incidents, are these sort of like smash and grab things. And thinking of, like, if somebody broke into your house, and you have a sliding glass door in the back of your house, the smash and grab would be, you come home and the first thing you notice is there's a broken sliding glass door, there's glass on the floor, there are muddy footprints that come in through the broken door, lead all the way to your room where your secret jewelry box is hidden, and the jewelry box is forced open, and there's a couple of earrings along the track of the muddy footprints heading back out the back door. That's your ransomware attacks. That's some of your brute force attacks and whatnot. And these APT-like or more sophisticated attacks are more like the occasion where you come home and you actually don't see anything different in your house, but your security camera captured somebody breaking, not breaking, but compromising the lock on the sliding door, easing it open, and somebody creeping through your house with, you know, little booties on their muddy feet and not leaving a trail at all, opening the jewelry box and only selecting a couple of items, and then walking out, shutting the door behind themselves and locking it again. It makes me, some people say, well, gee whiz, don't I need to be worried about that? And I would say, yes, if you are somebody who administers tokens and keys for Microsoft's online web access, Outlook web access, yes, you should be worrying and validating these things. That's your job, man. You have one thing to do, and that's that. But there are millions of people like me who just want our email to work. And so we subscribe to a reputable organization that we entrust with all of that. And so, you know, the first thing that jumps out at me with this is not your run of the mill. Somebody had a weak password. Somebody didn't use multi-factor authentication. Somebody left an old account lying around out there with, you know, like, you know, whatever, on a VPN, hashtag Colonial Pipeline or whatever.
Right.
But this is a level of sophistication that you say, goodness gracious, this is the domain of real professionals. I think I look at it from two optics. One is, as a normal consumer, this is why I pay my annual fee to Microsoft or whoever, because I say, this kind of stuff is your job, not mine. I just want my stuff to work and to be reasonably secure. And this is why when my computer says, I have an update, do you want me to install it? Yes, please, because there's a reason somebody did this. And then the other optic is, yeah, from that professional, as you've said, it's really all of the things that we do as consumers of, you know, well, do you have a good password? Are you using multi-factor authentication and whatever else? But it's taken to that next level to say, am I validating things that need to be validated? Am I looking at even, you know, am I, when so many times as an FBI agent back in the, you know, sort of one-off breach situations, well, what's the first place you want to look? Well, who did you fire recently? Or what contractors did you have in your system that you may not have offboarded properly? Did you actually go through and eliminate all of their accesses? That, I would say, is kind of the mid layer, you know, and then an attack like this just is a whole nother layer of sophistication, where this is where, like, graduates from our programs are really earning their money, because they're doing the stuff that not only keeps their company's data safe, but all of us who rely on their companies to keep ourselves safe too.
Whitworth University is a small private Christian university located in Spokane, Washington. The school manages information for more than 3,000 students a year. Whitworth University became aware of a sophisticated hack of their systems on July of 2022. The Whitworth University attack occurred by a group of hackers that broke into the network and began copying and encrypting files. They leveraged their position to try and get a ransom from Whitworth. The attackers asked for a ransom to give the information back and to keep from spreading the data around the internet. The attack occurred on July 29th, 2022. And after a full investigation, it was determined that over 65,500 students were affected by the total breach. The majority of data taken during the breach was personal student information. Data included social security numbers, health information, birth dates, student ID numbers, passport numbers, and more. That information could be seriously harmful to the students involved in the breach, and there was reason for them to be worried about what will happen to their data. I think this resonates to our social security question earlier about, you know, protection. We like to describe the response. So how did Whitworth respond to this particular breach? In July of 2022, students and parents at Whitworth University were unable to access their information via university websites. Rumors began via Instagram of a potential ransomware attack on university systems. 3 weeks later, Whitworth acknowledged for the first time that the institution had been hit by a cyber attack. The university would not confirm or deny the rumors that the cyber attack involved a ransom. Days later, the LockBit ransomware group claimed responsibility for the attack, indicating that it had stolen 715 gigabytes of data and set a ransom deadline of August 23rd. Whitworth University informed the state attorney general's office in October that a data breach that summer was a ransomware attack and that may have affected thousands of former and current students. And currently, there is a lawsuit filed in June of 2023 in the U.S. District Court of Spokane, Washington, that alleges Whitworth was negligent in allowing the still unidentified attacker to access health, financial, personal data of past, present students, security, and faculty. So this is a pretty brutal breach that Whitworth went through. And it seems like they were able to get through the network here. Any thoughts, you know, broadly on ransomware, mid-size or small-size companies? Certainly, phishing is a vulnerability, but there's plenty of others.
Well, it's happening to a lot of universities, unfortunately, since then. I think the key, we have a theme here, Dustin. Do you have a communication plan for a breach?
I mean, right.
The reason why they couldn't communicate with the parents and the students is everything's locked down. Everything. They couldn't even tell you who the students and parents were during that period of time that the hackers took control of everything.
Yeah.
That's the problem, right? So outside of your database that's sitting there and they now have locked up, how do you communicate with students to let them know it's happening? So their frustration levels, I understand. But you have to rewind and go, we're a technology globe now. People don't have a phone book sitting on their desk anymore going, I need to call these 3,000 students and warn them real time.
Yeah.
So what is your communication plan for any organization if you are locked down by ransomware, right? Because what will transpire once it's locked down, yes, there'll be the ransomware. There'll be attorneys looking. If it's an amount that's large enough, the FBI will be involved. That also feeds into the timeline of what they can say and can't do, right?
Right.
So not only is everything locked down and they can't access anything, they may not be able to say anything because FBI is involved, right? Like we saw with a couple of the other universities that this happened to more recently, or the legal teams involved going, do you pay this? There's just so many things happening at once. I feel bad for them. I think there's just... it's just this horrific moment that you go, you think you're going to work, you're logging in, and the whole school is shut down.
Right? Yeah.
So I think they responded to it as best as they could because there's not a template for how to handle this. So what should businesses do? You do disaster recovery if your servers go down. If you're in the software industry or financial industry or whatever, what would you do if you couldn't get into your company?
Yeah.
And how do you put in the safeguards now to say, okay, we are a hospital. We need to update all the patients. Where do we have the patient's information that is not tied to a computer and they could lock it down?
Yeah. Right?
It's those steps and that lens of a disaster that we have to start applying to companies internally when it comes to a ransom attack.
Yeah.
Because we're all technology, and it's like, okay, well, you were technology yesterday. Today, it's 1985, and you're sitting there with a phone and a desk. So what are you going to do? Because that's how far they go when they take control of everything.
I think one thing that really stands out to me too, Raphael, is you can't put your data in one basket. There's nothing wrong with having a paper backup copy of everyone. I realize it's a big filing cabinet, but you may need it. Yeah.
Or it's encrypted somewhere, or your legal team, which is a different, you know, if you have outside legal services, they have it somewhere, right? It's like, what do you do to protect your data and your bank accounts in a way that is not the traditional path we've done over the last 5 years?
Yeah. We wanted to talk about something a little different, which is the recent LockBit takedown by law enforcement with you, especially since you have this background in law enforcement. And so I saw the article on Wired, that's where it first came my way, that a number of different international law enforcement agencies had gone after LockBit, a prolific ransomware attacker, and I think kind of an interesting organization. And maybe we should start there. Like, what do we know about LockBit?
Yeah, I mean, you know, so what's really interesting, and I like to tell the story of how ransomware became a thing when we talk about any ransomware family.
Yeah,
because I think it shows sort of how the bad guys think. So, you know, if you look 15, 20 years ago, the Zeus Trojan, which is like one of the original banking Trojans, that was kind of the big deal, right? And I you know, made my career off of Zeus with the Niebuhr botnet stuff, if you've read about that.
Yeah.
But the cyber criminals were like, okay, we're going to put this piece of malware on your machine. And when you log into your bank, we're going to steal your credentials. And then we're going to go, you know, steal your bank account info. And that worked for a good long while, right? It took a good long while for the banks to figure out how to fight that. You know, the banks eventually figured out how to fight it, and the bad guys kind of went back and went, all right, so that worked pretty well. I was getting a bunch of bank credentials. I was getting a bunch of credit cards. What else can we do? And they go, ah, fake AV. You know, let's do fake AV. So then they, you know, they bring the fear element into it. You know, your machine is infected. You need to download this and you need to install it and we'll solve your problem.
Yeah.
So a lot of people did that. Oh, and also you need to pay us $30 to, you know, to get the product. So what they ended up with is access to your machine, your credit card information, and $30, right? So they're, you know, sort of leveraging and increasing their ability to do that. And then the bad guy or the good guys, you know, it's this arms race where we got better at detecting the fake AV and it became not as much an issue. And the bad guys kind of went back to the drawing board and they went, okay, so the fear thing worked really well. How else can we leverage this? Ah, let's do ransomware. Let's put this malware on this machine. Let's infect it. Let's encrypt it. And let's make them pay us to get it back. That's worked, right? Ransomware is huge. It's probably the biggest malware threat now. And I think that sequence of events really shows how the bad guys are like opportunistic and entrepreneurial. They tend to kind of look back at the lessons they've learned and go, how can we fix this? You know, how can we move ahead? You know, so if you look at Lockbit is like the ultimate example of that, because not only are they doing the ransomware thing, but they've also discovered, like many ransomware groups have, that the data exposure piece is also huge, right? So not only will I infect your machine and, you know, or your environment and get a bunch of ransomware on your machines, but also steal some data and say, all right, you got to pay the ransomware to get those things off your machine, but you also got to pay me or I'm going to release all your data.
Yeah.
And that's a really interesting approach. And if you look at Lockbit, they're probably one of the most mature ransomware groups. You know, they've got like customer support and, you know, they're able to, you know, sell things and they have a blog site and, you know, it's just a really like very business focused, business oriented, you know, criminal enterprise at that point. The really interesting thing, and this happens a lot with those takedowns, is, you know, you asked about my background in law enforcement and doing takedowns. So I've been involved with a number of these malware takedowns. And back in the day, like a while ago, it was much easier because typically the malware would use, you know, a web server or something for command and control. So as long as you're able to figure out what that web server was, you could just go take that domain down or take the, you know, web server down, and then the malware was dead.
Yeah.
Zeus is a great example of that, because Zeus went from, you know, functioning in that way and getting taken down enough that they eventually went, all right, we're sick of this. Let's build some peer-to-peer functionality into this malware. So not only did the malware reach out to this command and control server to get info, it also reached out to its peers. So then you take the command and control servers down. As long as you still have access to one of those peers, you can reinvigorate the network, right?
Yeah.
You know, so it got really interesting. And then the next part of that was this whole domain generation algorithm piece, which was, I'm going to have this algorithm that creates domain names on my controller, and then I'm also going to have it on the malware itself. And that malware is going to create a domain that it's going to use for command and control on the fly. I'm going to know what that domain is because I've got the same thing on my side. Mm-hmm. I'm going to register that domain, and then we can kind of do the thing, right?
Oh, wow.
And that basically made it very resilient to the takedown efforts, because we never knew which domain was coming next. So the way that the good guys approached that is they reverse engineered the malware, reverse engineered the algorithms, and then they were registering those domains ahead of the bad guys to keep them from being able to do command and control. So it's like, you know, very, very complex. And it's a great example of how the bad guys sort of use it as an arms race, and they learn from the previous, you know, activity. Like they knew that the domain thing was a takedown risk. So how do we fix that? Let's do domain generation. Let's do peer to peer, et cetera.
Yeah.
The Lockbit takedown is a great example. And one of the things I pointed out was, I expect that they'll come back. And what, they were down for a week and
we
were back?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, that was largely for, you know, the reasons I said is the feds took the, you know, all the PHP servers down. They had backup somewhere that they were able to pull things back up. They just went, oh yeah, they took it down. Let's pull it back up and you know, keep on going. Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting. The takedown thing is tough these days.
Yeah. One of the things I read, you know, Lockbit posted on re-bringing up the servers, and reading through the documentation, they mentioned how their servers were running PHP, but not all of their backups included PHP. That's an interesting decision, right? Because you're like, I'm sequestering out certain technologies in my backup methodology because that could get infected for a long period of time. And if I don't have PHP in the fundamental files, I can reload those files on new server versions. And I don't think a lot of large entities think about that. They're like, I have backup. It goes for a certain period of time. I check the box, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, the whole backup thing is like, you know, that's one of the primary ways you should fight the ransomware, right? Is to have your backups and, you know, offline and available to, you know, to you know, turn your machines back on when they get ransomware. You know, the bad guys take those lessons too, and they go, all right, let's back up our stuff so if it's taken down, we can sort of stand it back up. And what's super challenging about that is, you know, when you look at a law enforcement effort like this, you know, it requires so many moving pieces and so many things to happen at the same time, because if they don't get all those machines, all those command control machines at once, as long as one is still active, you know, they can keep the network alive.
Yeah.
You know, so if you look at Microsoft and the Digital Crimes Unit and the way that they're attacking this is, you know, they're doing it legally, right? They're going and saying this entity is infringing on our digital rights or intellectual property. And, you know, they're able to use the courts to seize some of the equipment and do those sorts of things. Whereas previously it's largely been just a technical endeavor. But yeah, so many moving parts. And if you miss, and, you know, in this day and age, if you miss one piece, you know, the bad guys just go up. They missed that one. Let's bring it back up. And that's what we're seeing.
There's this knee-jerk reaction a lot of times when we get a security incident notification that it's a nation state actor. But now I think we're seeing a lot more that these are more groups. But I think it's very muddy, right? Some of these groups may be funded by people that have parallel goals, but they're making their own money. They're independent as they want to be on some level.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you look at like Russia is a good example of this. So, you know, a lot of cybercrime is Eastern European focused, and it has been historically. And, you know, Russia has always had the rule that they sort of turn a blind eye if you don't attack Russia.
Yeah.
They'll protect these guys that are kind of doing that work. And the advantage they have there, too, is that when, you know, the intelligence agencies in Russia need some specific data, they can often go to these cybercrime operators and go, you know, I need a email address from the Pentagon. Do you have one? And they go, oh, yeah, we got this guy with ransomware. Here you go. Right. So it allows the nation states to sort of be involved, but have that deniability to say, oh, no, those were the Romanian cybercrime guys. It wasn't us.
Yeah.
And then, you know, if you look at like North Korea, you know, North Korea is doing work that is very much cybercrime, right? They're very focused on cryptocurrency theft. And that's largely because they can fund their regime with that cryptocurrency, even, you know, with all the sanctions, because it's hard to track and easy to transfer and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
You know, so you definitely have this sort of muddying of the waters and, you know, this bleeding of something that's typically APT that's now in the cybercrime space. The ransomware actors are another great example, too, because you've got very competent hacking teams. They're doing cybercrime in a way that historically was only done by the nation state teams, right? Because of the resourcing and stuff that they had.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's really interesting. There's a whole different level these days.
And to your point, they run it like a business, right? Like they're selling code. They're selling some of their software that they write to perpetrate the crimes that they're doing via their website on top of the ransomware income that they're generating. They've got hierarchies, they've got reviews, they've got quality assurance, they've got security controls in place, obviously, for resilience. It's really quite intriguing, but it's got to be lucrative enough to build an organization with that kind of, well, robustness. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the underground, the barrier to entry to cybercrime has gotten just lower and lower as time has gone by. You know, back in the day, you had to sort of have some technical knowledge to be able to build malware and do some of this stuff. Nowadays, you go into the underground and go, I need access to this network. Who has access? And some, you know, access broker will be like, oh, I have it here. I can sell it to you. Oh, I need some malware. Who can write me some malware? Oh, I've got it. I'll sell it to you. I tend to equate it to like a swap meet. You know, you walk in and there's a table everywhere and every table selling something different. And you can piece together what you want to do by going to one of these, you know, each one of these tables. So, you know, if I, as a fairly unskilled script kiddie type person, want to go and do cybercrime, I just need to get access to some of these forums and I can buy what I need for the most part.